Bloomberg News on Demand.
Bloomberg News on Demand is brought to you by the new Porsche Panamera. Four, uncompromised.
Bloomberg Surveillance with Ken Pruitt and Tom Keane. Wednesday, October 28, 2009.
This is Bloomberg Surveillance in primetime.
Even with all the fiscal stimulus, we're going to see the credit markets continue to be impaired.
A tiny number of supergiant firms, the survivors, are now too big to fail.
I think at this point, the crisis had spread far beyond housing.
It seems to me clear that the dollar is going to fall another 10, maybe even 20%.
I personally believe the dollar will suffer mightily.
You're not going to get consumer growth like we had in the past 10 years. The consumer is reeling.
Bloomberg Surveillance in primetime. Your link to the world of economics, finance, and investment. Now from Bloomberg World Headquarters in New York, the moderators of tonight's program, Kim Fox and Kathleen Hayes, on Bloomberg Radio.
All right. Good evening and welcome to a special primetime edition of Bloomberg Surveillance. And this unique program celebrates its one-year anniversary on Bloomberg Radio. I'm Pim Fox. I'm wearing a bow tie. We're ready to go. Host of Taking Stock, I am now joined by my colleague Kathleen Hayes, the host of the Hayes Advantage.
Thank you, Pim, and what a pleasure to be here tonight. You know, it's been such a crazy year for the economy and the markets. Stocks hit a 12-year low, unemployment soared, consumer confidence plunged. In short, the ideal time to launch a radio program devoted to exploring the world of finance and investment.
And indeed, that exploration continues tonight with our special guests, Harvard University professors Niall Ferguson and Kenneth Rogoff. We also have questions from our studio audience here at Bloomberg World Headquarters in New York.
And now, to celebrate 1 year of Bloomberg Surveillance, what you've all been waiting for, your hosts, Ken Pruitt and Tom Keene.
Kathleen, thank you so much. Pim, you look dapper, Pim, tuxedo and all. We didn't know which way to go here. Thank you, folks. Welcome to our audience in our headquarters and to all of you worldwide listening this evening with us, Ferguson and Rogoff. And a particular thanks to Ken Rogoff. You literally just left class.
We won't get into the details.
It was an ugly sight, but we greatly appreciate it. The rain and all. I want to start with the two books, The Ascent of Money. Many of you know This Time is Different, Reinhardt and Rogoff. And here's Niall Ferguson on the cover. This is quite simply the best empirical investigation of financial crises ever published. Let's start with the idea, Professor Ferguson. Are we still in crisis?
I think we are. Crises last longer than most people think. What was it, 80 years ago today? We still like to think of black days. But most crises, major financial crises, worthy of the name depression or indeed recession, last significantly longer than a day. And they can be measured more in the thousands of days. I think it would be very unwise to say it's over. And I was very disturbed when global leaders started to talk as if they thought it was over at the recent G20 summit.
The G20 in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
Right. Professor Rogoff, are we over? I mean, this is such an authoritative work. Jim Presley out of Brussels says it's definitive. Martin Wolf calling it a masterpiece. Within the body of research that you and I have talked about, with This Time is Different, is there a belief here that we can get through it this quickly within a matter of 2 or 3 years?
Well, yes and no. I mean, the G20 is right that it's over for all the banks they guaranteed, but the problem, it's not over for them. The debt's piling up. We're looking at records, levels we just don't see outside wartime, really. And I think that in some ways the financial crisis may eventually morph into a government debt crisis.
Well, are we there now? Let's go to the one thing you're in both agreement on. I mean, you're teaching Western Ascendancy. That sounds like a Harvard course. Is that like Western Civ renamed?
It is Western Civ renamed, and I renamed it because I wanted to make the point that over 500 years something quite extraordinary happened. It started in the 1490s. And a relatively small proportion of the world's population in northwestern Europe and then in their colonies in North America and Australasia ended up dominating the world. It's really quite hard to explain how that came about because you wouldn't have predicted it if you dropped into the world in 1490. The big question is whether we're living through the end of that period of Western ascendancy. So the course I'm
teaching
is designed to answer that.
All right, get us to May of 2010. Give us the punchline here now. Is this the end?
I certainly think we're close to some kind of historical tipping point. One has the sense of history speeding up at this point. And although we don't have such a thing as the future, we can only talk of plausible futures. A very plausible future at the moment is that within our lifetimes, the United States will cease to be the world's largest economy. And that is a fundamental rebalancing of the world that really is a one in 500 years event.
Is this because of the fiscal deficit, what you've been talking about for years? Is this build up in 200% Japan GDP and wherever we are right now?
No. I mean, it's really China discovering itself and the growth in Asia. That's a larger force. The financial crisis, the fiscal crisis may accelerate the trend, as Neil was saying, but I think it's something larger that if they fail to do it, it'll be because their own economies implode.
Now we'll talk some of these themes this evening. Ken?
Well, I'd like to join Tom in thanking you both for coming down today on a difficult travel day. And about those World Series tickets we promised you, we're still working on. The first pitch isn't for, you know, an hour and a half or so just relax.
Well, with the traffic we take so long to get there, it wouldn't matter.
I wanted to ask both
also,
of you.
We're Red Sox fans, aren't we?
Yes, yeah, we are. Thank you, Neil.
Tom, we don't care about the World Series in Boston. Yes,
that's what right.
World Series? Yes. What is that?
I'm outnumbered. I want to know what you guys see today. When you step back and look at the big pictures, what do you see in the economy right now?
Well, it's often been described in terms of letters of the alphabet or symbols, and we've had some people fantasizing about V-shaped recoveries and other people fretting about W's. The latest that I've heard was the square root, where you have the crisis, then you have a rebound, and then you flatline. And somebody was trying to sell me the idea of the ski jump the other day, where you fly up in the air and then you fall back down again rather spectacularly. I must say my feeling is that the square root is a reasonable description in the sense that I think after this banking crisis is behind us and we enter the phase of fiscal crisis, as Ken Rogoff was saying, it's likely that U.S. growth will surprise on the downside. And I think the official forecast the administration put out earlier this year will look pretty comical in hindsight, because we're much more likely to have a trend growth rate closer to 2% real in the United States than 3 or 4%, which is what people have been hoping for. So that, I think, is where the U.S. is at. But I think a more interesting question is where the global economy is at. A lot of people talked about this in terms of a crisis originating in global imbalances, and there was some talk of the imbalances receding as a result of the crisis. I think that talk was for the birds. The imbalances are back, and in some ways they're worse, because as the dollar weakens, and as China follows the dollar down by means of its dollar peg, the pain is being transferred in a really interesting way from what I call Chimerica, China and America, to the rest of the developed world, to Japan and to Europe. And that is the big story right now. They are the ones who are bearing all the pain of this global crisis.
Ken, let's pick up there with your experience at the IMF. What will be the response of those other nations in Asia, Brazil and others, as China holds that peg?
Well, there's not much they can do, is there? I mean, I think that there's a lot of unhappiness with it, but China's running these massive surpluses, building up all these reserves, and until they feel like changing, I'm not sure what the world can do. I mean, we could threaten them with isolation in trade and other retribution, but it's very, very tough. And we Americans are not about to stop borrowing as long as they'll let us, give us money for nothing.
Well, Professor Rogoff, are you a V-shaper, a W-shaper? We had a guest on the show recently who was answering this question, and halfway through the answer, I realized he was describing a Nike swoosh.
I have to look at my son's shoes. I've never been a believer in a V-shape. You do often get V-shape recoveries out of deep recessions, but when you have a financial crisis like this, it's not the norm. That's certainly what Carmen Reinhart and I find in our book, This Time is Different, that when you look at other deep financial crises, it's a long, slow haul. And especially things like unemployment, housing prices, they're going to take a long time to come back.
If you're just joining us, folks, worldwide on Bloomberg Radio with us, the Cabot Professor at Harvard, Ken Rogoff, Tisch Professor Ferguson. Paperback out soon?
Paperback out now.
Are the
Ascent of Money
out now? Excuse me.
Now.
We only deal with hardcovers here. The Ascent of Money, a Financial History of the World.
You got the hardcover.
Oh, you
I got
the paperback. Okay. And This Time is Different, which I'm going to hold up for our audience here assembled. It's got the Mad Men cover on it. Is that Neil jumping there?
That's me blurbing.
This Time is Different. Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff. Ken, what a great box here. 1929, 200 Varick Street. It's a Chipotle Mexican grill now,
I guess so.
Where the standard statistics was. Famous wrong guesses in history. 1929, everything's going to be wrong. Today is going to be fine. Well, they got that wrong. But then there was 1936-37. Where are we now in the continuum of getting it wrong? What is the certitude or confidence that you see now that you would suggest is suspect?
Well, I mean, I don't think we're going to have another Great Depression. I just don't think we're going to get it that wrong. That really took a lot of things coming together. But I do see a long era of slow growth among the rich countries. There's a big adjustment, and especially here in the United States. The consumer is going to be consolidating for a long time. Credit markets are weak. The banks are still weak. State and local governments are restructuring. The government and the Fed have to figure out how to exit from this massive stimulus. It's a very difficult road ahead. It's a hard context to have a V-shaped recovery. I think we probably have subpar growth, something like the 2% Neil said, for a long time.
Neil, the political dialogue in Washington, Ken and I were talking about this. One of the things, folks, is Ken and I don't plan this. We just make this up. It was one of the original decisions we made about 55. The planning for Bloomberg Surveillance was only like about 22 minutes. I mean, there weren't a lot of meetings. And one of the things we said is we wouldn't plan things. But Ken, you said earlier, this idea of the present political debate. Is the intrusion of Washington into the financial and capitalist debate now normal, given crises? Is this what governments are expected to do?
Well, I think Ken Rogoff made a good point earlier when he drew a parallel with wartime, because we've only ever seen this kind of expansion of government into the banking system and the financial system as a whole during the world wars previously. I've been saying for some time that we have all the symptoms of a world war financially without the war itself. And it's, I think, deeply unhealthy. It may have been necessary to take emergency measures this time last year. The problem is that these emergency measures were taken without any real conditions. And now a frantic improvisation is going on to figure out a way of removing the explicit government guarantee to the survivors among the TBTFs, the too big to fail institutions. And everything I hear emanating from Washington depresses me more, because it seems to me the people taking these decisions are probably the worst qualified people that you could find in this country, namely members of U.S. Congress. I mean, just a single example of something that gets me down is the idea that you're going to essentially keep the too big to fail institutions, but if there's ever another major failure, then after it's happened, you'll make them pay for it. This is about the most absurd and implausible idea I've heard in a long time.
Ken, please jump in on this.
Well, indeed.
Right, I thought of this today, the moral hazard. I actually looked up Rogoff Obstfeld to see if it was there. The moral hazard now, this is original territory, isn't it?
No, I mean, it's the idea that you're going to go say, here, you can have anything you need, but next time we're going to be really tough. My 11-year-old daughter, Giuliano, has me wrapped around her finger, knows really? That when I tell her, you know, well, I wasn't tough this time, but next time, you know, it's really going to come down on you. You know, she knows better, and I think the banks do. I think the too big to fail is a really central issue. I mean, they talk about economies of scale, but at this size, are there diseconomies of scale? Are these, you know, institutions really at an optimal size, or are they just maximizing taxpayer support?
Well, Professor Ferguson, is Washington really the financial capital now? And if it is that a permanent shift?
Well, let's hope it's not a permanent shift, because when you look at the way the political system functions in Washington right now, what Americans have, though they may not realize it, is a parliamentary system without the benefits of a parliamentary system, because there's no party discipline. And that's a really fascinating state of affairs. When I first came and worked in this country In 2002, it was still very clearly a presidential system. When you went to Washington, there was no question that the man in the White House was in charge. But now Barney Frank is in charge, and Nancy Pelosi is in charge. And it's not, I mean, there are a whole bunch of these people. I struggle to remember all their names. And they're all in charge simultaneously, and they're all putting together a massive omnibus financial regulation bill, which, when you consider the way they're going about this, is probably going to be one of the most appalling pieces of legislation ever devised in this country. And if that is the future, of course, Wall Street is still Wall Street. It's still based here, but the regulations are being devised, reinvented in Congress. And, of course, nobody is pointing out the role that Congress played in this crisis to begin with. After all, let's not forget, some of the most heavily regulated institutions under the direct supervision of Congress, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, were at the epicenter of the crisis. So it's deeply troubling. If that's where the financial headquarters of the West is, then full speed ahead, China.
With the time we have, and with the great questions we have, folks, again, worldwide surveillance in prime time with Ken Rogoff and Neil Ferguson and a terrific live audience here at our world headquarters. We'll hear from John Riding and Kathleen Stephenson and others in a minute with their questions and hopefully get in many answers here as well. We've got to go to the international sphere with your work. This is from The Ascent of Money, page 313, and this is something Ken and I have talked about for. Ferguson quotes Rogoff, and this is this modest tiff of a number of years ago with Joseph Stiglitz, and we don't need to go into the details of that other than to say, this is great, Ken. We at the we on planet Earth have considerable experience suggesting otherwise. We Earthlings have found that when a country in fiscal distress tries to escape by printing more money, inflation rises, often uncontrollably. Well, you wrote that when the deficit was a little bit different than it is now, and you've got European deficits as well. What do you envision in 2011 or 2013? How do we extricate ourselves at the margin out of these deficits?
It's not easy. I mean, by the way, the United States has so far been in a different position that we keep printing money and printing debt and the world buys it. But I think the lesson of history, and I'm sure Neil Ferguson would agree, is that it ends really suddenly when it ends, that you think everything's fine, it's not something to worry about. You need to get out ahead of this. You can't decide that you're going to start dealing with it in 2016. And I'm not pretending that the recession's over or we can pull back, but we at least need to lay out a course where the fiscal policy is going to get under control, but the world will do it for us. I mean, the Chinese will decide someday that they've had enough. And say we knew it was 5 years from now, that seems like a long time. What would we do in 5 years? How would we really prepare to deal with that? Our tax rates are so low, our spending, it's so inflexible. It is a difficult position, but it's worse for a lot of smaller countries.
Neil, as we celebrate the 60th anniversary of the Chinese Revolution, we've got the guard in now. There's an identified next guard, which I think is in 2 years off the top of my head. They switch power. And then there's that next guard. Is that the catalyst, that third generation of present Chinese leadership, the 40-year-olds that will become the 60-year-olds in Ken's 2016?
Well, I don't pretend to have a hotline to the leadership of the Chinese Communist Party, but my understanding from those who know more about this than I do is that a really important shift is going to happen quite soon within the Chinese leadership, and that the next generation, you even need to go to the third, is going to be significantly more assertive and less, I think, docile with respect to the United States than Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao have been. We, I think, assume complacently that America will just carry on and the Chinese will continue to buy debt from us and accumulate dollar-denominated reserves because, and I've heard this so often in the United States, where else can they go? And so we sit back and relax and assume that this game can continue indefinitely. But it clearly can't. I mean, there is an upper bound to how much in the way of reserves the Chinese can accumulate. They're already at an incredible historic high in relation to GDP.
Well, the extrapolation's $3 trillion of June of next year.
This is already vast. vastly beyond anything we've ever seen before. Sometimes people draw comparisons with the Bretton Woods system, when there were some similarities. West Germany and Japan had an export-led growth strategy. They did some of the things that the Chinese are doing, but they never accumulated reserves on this scale.
We never ran deficits on this scale.
Exactly. There weren't these incredible disequilibria, and so one can't assume that this goes on indefinitely. It's already, it seems to me, at a critical state. And I agree with Ken Rogoff. When this thing changes, it will be dramatic and non-linear. It won't be a gradual adjustment. There will be a moment when the international bond market says, wait a second, let's take a look at $9 trillion of new issuance by the U.S. Federal Treasury. And let's just look at this. It's not a Keynesian policy here. It is a fundamental structural deficit that they cannot solve politically because they can't get a consensus either to cut spending or to raise taxes. At some point, we have to price these instruments down. We're already pricing the currency down. The next question is, when do we price the bonds
down? Ken, how much is the... Well, go ahead, Ken, please.
Well, I mean, just a guess here, but when you look at the next generation of Chinese leadership, how many Harvard MBAs?
Well, interestingly, somebody was saying to me that the next Chinese leaders won't actually be English speakers. The people who are coming to the top in the Communist Party are not, in fact, the Harvard-educated elites, necessarily. And I think we'll see a more nationalistic China within a very small number of years. And they have alternatives. We act like they don't, but they do. I mean, it's not like they just have to switch overnight into euros in their international reserves. They're already doing the rational thing, which is to switch out of dollars into commodities. They're at the early phase of what will be a massive buying spree in emerging markets of all kinds of assets, mines, for example, that produce the commodities they need. And back in the spring, I said, don't worry about U.S. equities. Just load up on copper. Load up on anything that the Chinese want. That is the safest one-way trade you can make, and it's been true.
That's what I said. They're sending their kids to American universities, so that's happening in waves. But Neil Ferguson's absolutely right. I mean, if you meet the, you know, the next generation of leaders, that many of them don't speak English.
I want to go to questions here in about 4 minutes. So we'll start with John Reiting, who was our original guest on Bloomberg Surveillance. He'll be with us tomorrow morning in celebration of the event. But just to squeeze in a little more time here, Ken, we've seen recent dollar instability, trade-weighted major, trade-weighted broad, the real series. We're really moving down against that point where there seems to be a societal reaction against trade-weighted weakness. Where does that reaction come from? Is that Europe screaming, and then we say, oops, we got a strengthened dollar? How do you, when you're one deviation or deviation and a half off of the trend of trade-weighted major, what is the action that gets the dollar to strengthen? Is it political rhetoric? Is it a change in our behavior? Is it a change in Europe's behavior?
I don't think the dollar, you know, is necessarily going to strengthen. A lot of what's happened, of course, is that confidence has built and there was a flight to the dollar during the depths of concern about a Great Depression, and now it's coming back. But it's a wake-up call that we were running this big trade balance deficit, current account deficit, weren't particularly in control of it, and the dollar will suffer. The dollar's been declining for 40 years, more or less. Mm-hmm. But the concern is that, you know, it could go faster. And certainly if the euro shaped significantly, I mean, that really would be a problem.
Now, when you look at currency movements, where do they play within your historical perspective?
Well, I often think when I look at the dollar's trajectory of what befell sterling. After all, you don't get to be an international reserve currency forever.
How high was sterling in your childhood memories?
Well, I wish I could say in my childhood memories it was 486, but if you go back to the beginning of the decline of sterling, when it started to unravel from 1931 onwards, it was $4.86 to the pound. It takes a long time for an international reserve currency to lose its status. There's lots of path dependence. People are invested in it. They can't unwind their positions. But you do inexorably slide downwards, and there are periodic crises. And that was the story, certainly, of my life. I was born in 1964. 3 years later was the first of a succession of devaluations that punctuated my early life. And that seems to me to be the future for the U.S. dollar, a gradual slide downwards, mm-hmm. a gradual loss of reserve currency status punctuated by periodic crises.
Let me just pitch in that the loss of reserve currency status is most reflected in your interest rates creeping up. We got a premium on our interest rate, maybe 0.75%, 1% across the board, not just the Treasury. Britain had this in the late 1800s. It gradually went away by World War I. We may have accelerated that trend with the financial crisis.
No. Just one quick thought here, but old New York City slang for a $5 bill was a pound note.
Very good. With us, Pim Fox and Kathleen Hayes. Folks, we're trying to make midday smart. Kathleen Hayes, 12 to 3 p.m. She launched, what, like 8 days ago? It's great.
It's week five.
Week five, excuse me. It's wonderful. What do we have?
I've got John writing. I'm biting my tongue because I'm so dying to ask Ken and Neil questions, but I won't. I'll restrain myself and turn the mic over to John writing, RDQ Economics, as Tom said, the first guest ever on Bloomberg Surveillance.
Foolish enough to come on.
Yeah, and it was a holiday, as I recall.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm pleased to hear these concerns about balance sheets and imbalances and inflation. It seems to me the political process in the Federal Reserve is disconnected from reality. They talk about an exit strategy as if it's important to reassure us they have an exit strategy, but no sign of knowing when they want to even begin to implement that strategy. So I'm curious about both of your perspectives about how do you, even if you had the political will to do it, how do you begin to bring about an exit strategy? Because I see a kind of technical economics view of it. Well, it's okay if we neutralize the reserves, just like China neutralizes their $2.2 trillion of foreign exchange reserves, and we can technically get interest rates up when we need to, should we ever need to get rates up. So I'm kind of curious on the exit strategy thoughts from this.
I mean, the first thing to say is if we were a normal country, when you have a crisis like this, the central bank often comes in and buys up junk to sort of, ameliorate the crisis. But then after a little while, the government steps in and takes it off their balance sheet. And these mortgage-backed securities, they bought the agency debt. Normally, the Treasury should come in, create a vehicle, and pull it off their balance sheet. You don't want the Federal Reserve crippled by that. But unfortunately, Congress understands nothing, and is not adjusting the debt limit to do that. So I don't know what they can do about that. On raising interest rates, I mean, I think it's very delicate. You're exactly right, John. I mean, they want to say we have an exit strategy. We're not planning to exit in your lifetime, but we have an exit strategy.
What's really interesting is the absence of a fiscal exit strategy. I don't worry quite so much about our monetary exit strategy. It's clear that we're not going to have to exercise that anytime soon. But we do need to do something imminently about the fiscal credibility of the United States, because it simply can't be credible to have a trillion-plus dollar deficit every year for 10 years. That is asking for the kind of crisis that Ken Rogoff and I are talking about. So I think the exit strategy that could be implemented right now would be a new credible plan to get federal finances back on track over a 10-year time frame. And that can happen right now without negative economic consequences, because I'm not talking about tax increases tomorrow, but you have to have something that over a 10-year time frame makes some sense and gets you back into equilibrium.
Pim?
We have another question from the audience, from Kathleen Stephenson of Aladdin Capital.
Thank you for your comments. And you just stole my question here, John. In any event, perhaps we can go back to the too big to fail issue. And I wanted to know what your view is on, for both professors, what your view is on the issue of, or the view that Mervyn King has and the EU Commission. In other words, essentially dismantling
the
or
Edinburgh
making
speech.
Sorry?
The Edinburgh speech of a couple of days ago.
Right.
Was amazing.
It was a wonderful speech, not least because it revealed once again that Mervyn King is somebody in this business with a good sense of financial history. I strongly recommend.
He quoted Sir Walter Scott.
He quoted Scott, who was a victim of a great financial crisis of the 1820s that arose in the extremely poorly regulated Scottish banking system. I'm very sympathetic to the idea that we need to do something more than we are currently envisaging doing, because we've created a situation which is actually worse than it was before the crisis. If the crisis was caused by there being a few excessively large, excessively leveraged financial institutions, now we're in a situation in which there are even fewer of them, and they have an explicit, more or less explicit guarantee, because nobody wants to risk another Lehman. At the moment, I don't see anything in either the United States or in Europe that addresses this problem. In fact, what we're in the process of doing is institutionalizing too big to fail. And that can't be healthy. That reminds me of Rudolf Hilferding, the early 20th century German socialist's vision of state monopoly capitalism, of Finanzkapital, of financial capital becoming a quasi-state run concern. Mervyn King's argument that you need to separate the utility from the casino is actually a lot like what Paul Volcker has been saying. He's one of these advisors whose advice is ignored, which a particular breed you get in American politics. It strikes me that we need to think along these lines. It's not about going back to Glass-Steagall, because that is clearly something that belongs to a distant past. But we do, I think, need to come up with something more than we're currently envisaging. We need, in fact, perhaps, to break up these excessively large institutions. I don't think there is an argument for Citigroup or Bank of America anymore in their present form. I'm not even sure I like the prospect of a future in which Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan occupy the dominant positions that they occupy. And simply expecting this to sort itself out under present circumstances, where they can borrow money for free from the Fed, where they effectively are guaranteed by the taxpayer, when they can run up their value at risk as much as they like, this can't be a sustainable state of affairs. And yet the administration, just like the British government, seems to think it's okay.
And within this line, Ken, I know you want to comment on this, but within this line, does this change globalization if we break up these major firms which were advantaged by globalization?
Well, there's a bit of a question of whether one country can do it at a time if other countries don't. I mean, whether it's something we need to do at an international level. Mervyn gave a wonderful speech, I have to say. He was really out there and said a lot of things that needed to be said.
Catherine?
Catherine Stephenson, go ahead.
It's like the White House. You get a second question.
Quickly.
The framework in which this can take place, regulatory processes, or is it the free market that does this, which we don't think it would happen?
Well, we don't have a free market at the moment in financial services. We have a heavily regulated, government-guaranteed market. It's almost the antithesis of a free market. I wrote a piece recently on this in which I argued that if you could somehow credibly withdraw the guarantee, then the cost of capital would increase, and we might actually expose the diseconomies of scale that are at the heart of the whole Citigroup Bank of America story. The trouble is, and this goes right back to Ken Rogoff, daughter, how can any government credibly say next time it'll be different? And that's why I don't think market forces will do it. The market assumes there'll always be a bailout. If you're big enough to be able to say, remember Lehman, they'll pay up. The taxpayer's on the hook. And that's why I think we need to go beyond market forces here to undo the very unmarket-like things that we've done.
Well, who does this? I mean, neither one of you has been especially complimentary about Congress.
Well, I think the regulatory impulse is much better coming from central banks. And that's why it's no coincidence that it's the governor of the Bank of England who's actually made the most coherent statement on this front. It's about reasserting the role that central banks used to have, not merely as institutions for setting interest rates, but as authentic regulators and supervisors of the financial system.
Ken, please.
This was especially in England, where the Labour government broke off the regulatory arm from the central banks.
So they made the FSA.
They made the credit of the FSA. And what a blunder. I mean, it's just 180 degrees in the opposite direction of what you really want to do.
If you're just joining us, folks, Surveillance in Primetime with Kathleen Hayes, Pim Fox, Ken Pruitt, and Tom Keene. And with us, we welcome all of you worldwide in our audience and our world headquarters. Kathleen, we got another question.
Well, and we've got a lot of audience questions now, so let's see how many we can get to. Following up on John Ryding's question, and I think even on Kathleen's to an extent, what are Ben Bernanke, Larry Summers, and Christina Romer missing?
Ken?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say they're missing, but the politics, it's very hard to get things done. I think if you talk to them, they have very sensible ideas of where they'd like things to go. I mean, a very basic example is Larry Summers would have said we need, you know, the fiscal stimulus to be lasting, but temporary. And I think the public doesn't believe it's temporary. The class I left, Tom, to come here, I was teaching that if you really believe the stimulus was temporary, it would raise interest rates because there's that's the normal effect when people think it's temporary. I don't see the interest rates going up because nobody believes it's temporary.
Now, what should they do? How do they separate themselves from the political dialogue and pressures to get something done?
Well, I have the greatest respect for these people, and particularly for Larry Summers, who's one of the smartest people I know. But in the end, he's in the White House, and the president can only propose. It's Congress that disposes. And I think this was a pattern that was established early on with the stimulus bill. The White House said, we'd like a stimulus. You guys figure out how we spend the money. And I thought that was a fatal mistake. It was the moment at which the president essentially handed over vital decision-making to the legislature. And from then on, the legislature has been in the driving seat. So in a way, when it comes to be the time cover, you remember the committee that saved the world, which I think Larry was a member of, that when they do the committee that bankrupted America, they're going to have to get the whole of the U.S. Congress into that magazine cover, because you won't be able to pin it just on three economists.
Kathleen, another question.
Assuming we do nothing about deficits, what's the end result 10 to 15 years from now? What will the economy, markets, interest rates, and inflation be? And a range is okay. You don't need to give us point estimates.
Can we use scientific notation? I think the problem is these things end very abruptly and unexpectedly. I don't know if it's 10 years, 20 years. But
that's the major message tonight, by the way. It's not going to be a linear function.
Yeah, it's not linear. And 10 to 5 to 10 years now, actually, I'd say, at this current rate, we'll reach a point where what's going to happen, if we don't grow quickly, because that is the plan, we'll grow our way out of it.
What kind of model GDP do you need to get out of what we've seen now, like 7%?
They need 4 or 5% at least, as far as the eye can see, and it's not realistic.
Neil, other than in Asia with unique labor construct, has that ever happened before in a developed economy?
Well, it's actually a good question to pose, given the way that the Rogoff and Reinhardt book works, because we actually have a reasonably large sample of major banking crises that were followed by major fiscal crises. And what the book shows, and it's well worth dwelling on it, is that there are really two plausible scenarios. One is default, and the other is currency depreciation. And it kind of depends what your debt is like. If you owe the money to foreigners in their currency, you probably default. If you owe the money to foreigners and your own people in your own currency, then the currency probably depreciates. So if one's trying to think 5, 10, 15 years out, this looks like a scenario in which the dollar weakens, and therefore the value of the debt is reduced in terms of its purchasing power or in terms of other currencies. That's why I said on Bloomberg just a few days ago that a 10% decline in the real trade-weighted index for the dollar looks like just the first phase of a much more significant depreciation, because that's the lesson of history.
That's what we did to the Europeans in the 70s. They were holding tons of our treasury bills just like the Chinese are today, and the Chinese should ask them what happened.
John Connolly, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, famously said, our currency, your problem.
Yeah. Pim Fox, what do you have?
Let's talk about something prosaic. Let's talk about commercial real estate.
Good.
This is from Thomas Rich in Stanford. He wants to know, can you make an assessment as to the effects of the coming commercial real estate debacle? What's that going to do to the economy?
Well, one thing it's going to do is to reveal the profound difference in our financial system between too big to fail and too small to save, because this commercial real estate disaster hits banks that are too small to save all over the country. Regional banks, local banks are going to go down. It's already beginning, but there's some considerable way for this to go. And that's going to be fascinating, because it's another break on this so far pretty anemic recovery, don't you think?
I mean, I would just say it's a huge problem, but if it were happening by itself, it's sort of manageable. I mean, even the $1 trillion or whatever it is we're talking about, but it's probably not happening on its own. So when you throw that into the mix of the consumer adjusting, credit markets still being weak, et cetera, it's certainly challenging to deal with it.
Pim, another question?
This has to do with senior debt, right? The estimates of senior debt coming due in the next 24 months, staggering. A significant amount of this debt is projected to become non-performing loans. The impact on the economy, and how do we deal with it?
Well, I mean, I certainly think that, again, this is a case where, say, the example of the Federal Reserve having a lot of debt on its books that may sometime become non-performing can cause complications. and in the banking system with all the guarantees. I wouldn't say that the problem's not manageable. If we're growing decently, it'll turn out to be less of a problem. But if we're not growing at the 4 or 5%, which is the administration forecast, and I completely agree with Neil Ferguson, it's optimistic. If we're growing more at, say, 2 to 3% the next 4 or 5 years, it's going to be a mess.
Neil, please.
Think of this as a mountain of debt. You know, it's a big mistake only to focus on public sector debt and say, oh, we can relax, you know, even if we go to 100% of GDP, the Japanese are on 200. But you have to look at debt in the round. You have to look at the private sector debt as well. There have been very few cases in history of a society in which total public and private debt was equal to 3.5 times output. I mean, that's a really very large number. I don't think there was ever a time when the United Kingdom became that indebted. And so from that point of view, we're looking at a general crisis of leverage, of excessive debt, which we think we can solve with more debt.
That's right, because a lot of the confidence comes from the government's going to pay for it. Well, let's not worry about the bank debt. Let's not worry about anything. The government's guaranteed everything. But there are limits to that. And that's why looking at the private and public debt together, I think, is something that's important.
Kathleen, please.
Okay, gentlemen, you've talked about the weaknesses in the United States economy. What about the imbalances in the Chinese economy and their exit strategy?
Can they build a consumer business?
I think this is one of the most interesting questions we can ask right now. It's just extraordinarily difficult to answer because problems with the data. To believe some people, all we're seeing right now is a massive state-led investment program, which is creating overcapacity that ultimately will prove a source of future trouble. But others, and I think here of, say, Eric Fishwick for CLSA, say, no, this is a Keynesian success story. They're actually achieving what we try to achieve and fail to achieve because there's a multiplier in China. And also because it's more of a closed economy. So when you run out there and build a bunch of infrastructure, you actually start to get, through multiplier effects, increased consumption. I rather incline to the second view. On my most recent visit to Hong Kong, I was pretty amazed at what I was hearing about not just state-led infrastructure, but also about increased consumption, declining household savings. My sense is that something really very important is happening here, and that the Chinese are managing to change their growth model. It's hard to do. You can't do it in a month or a year, but they've achieved so much more in the space of 6 months than anybody was predicting, all of the experts, six months ago.
I'm honored to ask this question with your work with Carmen Reiner for years at the IMF. Do you share that optimism?
I'm a little more cautious about it. I mean, I just don't see anybody going for so long, growing so fast with so many financial complications and not having some big accidents along the way. China's day will come. I mean, which is not to say this won't be the Chinese century. It won't pass the United States eventually in GNP. But, I mean, the idea that it's going to go 40 or 50 years without a big financial crisis is just nonsense.
I agree with that. But I think it's important to remember that in some ways, if you think historically, China now occupies the position that the United States did in the 19th century with enormous potential in terms of productivity gains from investment in infrastructure. I mean, the productivity gains, when you look at the Chinese economy, are truly startling. And that means that this is not just some kind of rerun of Stalin's history, because there were no productivity gains in the Soviet economy. What is happening in China is altogether more persuasive and, I think, sustainable. There probably will be financial crises of some sort along the way. There have been in every single Asian miracle. But my sense is that given the legitimacy of the system, and remember, it's probably the most popular political system in the world right now in the eyes of its own people, it can withstand a few financial shocks.
Does this mean they become like us? I mean, not just in our position, the way it's been for a while, but does the society become like us?
Funnily enough, I was just before I came here being interviewed by Chinese state television for a large documentary series that they're putting together called Wall Street. The question is whether they're wanting to learn how to be like us or how not to be like us. And I think it might well be the latter. They're looking at our system and asking themselves, how can we avoid getting into a situation where we have financial institutions that are too big to fail? How can we avoid getting into a situation where entire public finances effectively get hijacked by the people running the banks and other financial institutions?
Ken, do you see them developing the social networks that so many say have to be jump-started? Social Security, welfare benefits, health benefits?
It's
I haven't seen it.
No,
I haven't seen the discussion.
But they could. I mean, they have this tournament system among their leaders where you're rewarded for your local GNP growth, your regional GNP growth. And if you build a hospital, that just doesn't deliver results. In fact, if you build a school, it doesn't deliver results. And they do talk in China about we have a 100% increase in how many hospitals we're building. But they weren't building many hospitals, so it's still very limited. It's really a big problem.
Kathleen, you have another question?
This just in from Alex Forrester of Rising Tide Capital. Pure free market capitalism doesn't seem to include the idea of diseconomies of scale. Does economic theory need to evolve in order to fix the problem of too big to fail?
This is a great question. Let's dive into this. You got Krugman. You've got Cochrane in Chicago, this battle going on. Where do you guys fit in on this?
Does economic theory
have to change?
I don't know if economic theory has to change. I mean, we have our norm, actually, is diseconomies to scale, and we have more trouble dealing with economies of scale. But it's really a question about these really big financial institutions, and some people look at it and say, it's natural. It's a natural monopoly, like we only have a few credit cards, and it makes sense to have only a few banks. And we should just create a tax to pull back the too big to fail part. But there are a lot of people, and I would assume Governor King would be in this category, that see these as reaching a size where they make no economic sense. And it's just getting this benefit of the taxpayer bailout. I mean, to be honest, as speaking as an economist, we don't know. I mean, we just don't know. We're suspicious, but I've never seen anything that really calibrated this.
Well, of course, I'm not an economist. That's one of the huge advantages I currently enjoy. And that means that I'm free to criticize an entire discipline. I mean, from the historical vantage point, of course, it's very anomalous for the United States to have very large financial institutions. That's a really recent phenomenon. You don't have to go back more than a couple of decades to a situation in which the top 10 institutions only accounted for about 20% of assets. Now they account for much more than half. And that's a real break with American tradition, which from the very inception of the United States was hostile to the idea of large financial institutions. Of the founding fathers, only Alexander Hamilton was comfortable with the idea, and he basically lost the argument. I think Americans have to realize how far this crisis came about, because their banking system morphed, for reasons that are really very interesting, into something more like a European or even a British banking system.
Pim Fox, squeeze in another question here.
A question coming from Michael Pond of Barclays Capital. You both seem to expect low growth but see risk of higher inflation from high deficits and a decline in the U.S. dollar. All right, so where do you invest?
I actually like emerging markets. I mean, if you want the honest answer to that question.
Yes, I think the interesting question about the timing of inflation is worth answering here, because I don't necessarily anticipate inflation anytime soon, given the deflationary world that we live in all kinds of ways. I'll be surprised if inflation expectations that we currently have, people expect 2-2.5% inflation, aren't disappointed. I think it may turn out to be much closer to zero than that. And there the problem becomes rising real interest rates. That's my big worry at the moment. From a historical point of view, it's perfectly possible for nominal rates to rise without there being actual increases in inflation. And that's your nightmare scenario, where you get rising long-term interest rates, but actually flat inflation. That's when a highly indebted economy really gets crushed. I think inflation is the answer to Americans' prayers if they but knew it, but I doubt very much that they're going to get it on anything like the scale that they need. To solve these problems of excessive indebtedness, you probably need something close to double-digit inflation. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. In fact, I would expect inflation to stay in single digits for many, many years to come. Does that mean I want to invest here? Absolutely not. No. Rush to the exits. I like Ken Rogoff. I'm looking at Chimerica. I'm looking at the China-America relationship, and I'm putting more and more of my money on China and related commodities and related economies.
Well, Ken, we've got just a couple of minutes with your courage to dash down here from Cambridge. Let's get a final larger thought from you. If we look at inflation, if we look at the dynamic, in the modern phrase, what should Ben Bernanke do? Like, what should Google do? Jeff Jarvis's book. What should Chairman Bernanke do?
I don't think the big question is in his hands. I think it's in Congress and the government. I think if fiscal policy is rudderless, there's nothing the central bank can do ultimately. Overpowering fiscal policy you know, no monetary policy can stand up to. I don't think this is an unmanageable problem. This is a political problem. We're very rich. We can deal with the problem. Of course, California is very rich, and California can deal with the problem, but it's difficult.
Argentina was once very rich, too.
True.
Well, when I started looking at currencies, the Lebanese pound was one of the three great currencies. Now, granted, there was some political... I mean, things can change. What's going to change?
I think the question is whether we can sort out the political gridlock that is really at the root of this problem. It's not just that the parties have a kind of a death embrace with these microphones are a wonderful advertisement for American technology, don't you think? Or were they made in China?
No,
we must find this out, I think, before we conclude this debate. But I mean, this it seems to me is a really, you know, it's a really fascinating question.
Thank you so much, the Tisch Professor at Harvard, Neil Ferguson. I'll hold up the book here, The Ascent of Money, now out in paperback. Thanks, Ken, for bringing that along. And, of course, Ken Rogoff, folks, this is a triumph with Neil Ferguson's comment on the cover. Carmen Reinhart and Kenneth Rogoff, this time is different. It is lots of data, lots of charts, but it's highly accessible with some just brilliant moments on, as Neil Ferguson says, the empirical investigation of these crises. We've got too many people to thank, particularly to Al Mayers, who sat me down one day and said, hey, dummy, let's do a morning program. And I thank Al for all the years, the 1 year suffering. Thanks to Kathleen Hayes, 12 to 3 p.m., the Hayes Advantage, getting off to a very strong start. And, of course, Pim Fox, now out in podcasts, with Taking Stock, 3 to 6 p.m. Pim wore the tuxedo at Chamorro. We've got to thank Vonnie Quinn, John Tucker, and Jerry Azar, who do it with us every day. As John turned to me and said, you mean it hasn't been 10 years? And very helpful. There's other people to thank. I want to thank one person, which is an example of how we use Bloomberg worldwide. Christina Harper was here earlier, our chief financial correspondent, all the resources of print helping us out. A few program notes. Tomorrow, Bloomberg, the first word with Ken Pruitt. We will get a start to the morning, particularly after a tumultuous 2 and 3 days. VIX up under 27. Also, of course, at 7 a.m., John Riding will join us. David Pearl, Andrew Ross Sorkin will join us on his new book, Too Big to Fail, and David Malpass. So we'll see you tomorrow.
The world's most interesting people are on Charlie Rose. Don't miss Charlie Rose, weeknights at 8 p.m. and 10 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Television.
There's more television and radio news at Bloomberg.com. Stream it live. Download it to your iPod or desktop. Copyright Bloomberg LP 2009.